The news of actor and comedian Robin Williams' death earlier this week shocked so many of us. Besides having been in rehab earlier this year, a statement released by his publicist confirmed that Williams had been battling severe depression of late. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 5 to 8% of Americans will suffer an episode of major depression this year, which equals 25 million of us. Yet only about half of those will receive treatment. Here to shed some light on the illness of depression, its effects, and treatment is Dr. Stephen Ilardi. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology at the University of Kansas. And Dr. Ilardi, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, when you learned, Doctor, that Robin Williams had taken his own life and that he had been depressed, how surprised were you?
Well, I think like most of us, I was saddened. I was shocked, but when I stepped back and thought about it more as a clinician and as a researcher, I have to say I wasn't terribly surprised. There's an extremely strong connection between suicide and clinical depression. And sadly, I think Robin Williams' case really illustrates many of the realities of that connection.
I mean, this notion, Doctor, again, that people are struggling with this, that he was a comedian who brought so much joy to so many people, and yet, you know, he was depressed. How unusual is that?
Not at all unusual. And in fact, you know, I've treated hundreds and hundreds of patients that suffer from depression. And one of the real common denominators is when they are not in the midst of a depressive episode, they're often joyous, thriving, robust individuals that lead incredible lives. And, you know, any of us can be struck down by this illness. When it takes hold, we become somebody else often. We become somebody that sometimes our friends and family don't even recognize. So it's not that surprising that somebody who was as gifted, as talented as Robin Williams, who brought joy to so many, when he was fully in the grip of this illness, all of a sudden now he doesn't really want to hold on to life.
You know, I want to talk about that pain a little bit, because I think a lot of folks don't appreciate exactly what that pain is all about. Interesting piece just the other day on Slate from Molly Polig, who suffers from depression herself. And she writes this in a piece I thought was so interesting. She writes this about her own experience. "There comes a point," she wrote, "where love does not matter. When things are bad, I don't care that people love me. All I can see is that I'm a burden, that everything I have ever done is wrong, and that these good people who love me are wrong as well. At my lowest, love cannot save me. Hope, prayers, daily affirmations, none of these can save me. Therapy and medicine are what matter, and those don't always work either." That sum it up pretty well, Doctor?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the things we really need to understand, actually two things, let me put out there quickly. First,
yeah,
depression is a really tragically misunderstood word in English language. The problem is the word depression in casual conversation, it simply means sadness. It's a synonym for just being down. That's something everyone experiences. So very often we hear the term depression referring to a clinical syndrome. It's a shorthand among us in the medical community and the psychological community. It's a shorthand for this devastating illness that affects the brain, it affects the body, it affects the way we see the world, the way we think about things. We use exactly the same word. And so many times when people hear a friend or loved one is quote-unquote depressed, they think, oh, well, that's no big deal. Everybody gets depressed. And the reality is, no, not everybody suffers from that debilitating illness. It's the number one cause of disability among all Americans under the age of 50. The second thing I wanted to put out really quickly is depression lights up the brain's pain circuits. The way the brain models pain, emotional pain circuits sit right next to physical pain circuits. And when one of them lights up, the other one also gets involved. Most of my depressed patients have told me they experience it as agony, and they can't even necessarily put their finger on exactly where the pain is coming from, what it involves, but it's torment, and they're seeking some form of escape. And that's why they often begin to think about death.
You said that so well. So this notion that when someone confronts another person who's suffering from depression and sort of says to that person, oh, come on, just buck up, I mean, that's not going to cut it very far, right?
Well, it's inadvertently quite cruel. I mean, none of us in our wildest dreams would ever imagine if we had a friend or loved one tell us, I've just been diagnosed with cancer. You know, we would never say, oh, come on, you know, just snap out of it, right? I mean, it would be ludicrous. And yet the person suffering from clinical depression, again, their brain has gone into a completely different mode of functioning, as has their body, as has their mind. This is an illness that's even robbing them of their ability to have restorative sleep, their ability to focus, to concentrate, their energy, their confidence, their ability to experience pleasure. And, you know, for someone to say, oh, just come on, buck up, or come on, let's cheer you up, which is a very normal human impulse.
Yeah.
Because if we have a friend who's simply sad, we will try to cheer them up, and that's exactly what we should do, and often we're successful. What happens when somebody's clinically depressed is their friends and family initially will rally around them. Their friends and family will say, oh, come on, let's help you get over this, which is a very fine impulse. The problem is it often requires quite a bit more than that, and so people get frustrated. Because they don't understand really the magnitude of what we're dealing with this illness.
We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Ilardi from the University of Kansas. So, Doctor, you know, how can the layperson begin to distinguish depression from someone who's just having a routine case of the blues?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And so the first thing is we want to think about how long is it lasting? If we're just simply reacting to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, if we're reacting to a disappointment, a loss, a setback, a normal adaptive healthy response, it might last for a few hours. It might even go on for a couple of days. But it's not going to go on for months and months and months. The typical episode of depression lasts for many months. Once it extends beyond 2 weeks, we start to get really concerned as clinicians. The second thing is, how does it affect functioning? If we're simply sad, if we're simply disappointed, you know, we're still going to be able to function. Now, it may be a little tougher to get our mind off whatever it is that we're upset about, but we're going to be able to continue to work, continue to socialize, continue to go about our business. Somebody who's struck down by clinical depression, it's going to start affecting how they function. Those are really the two biggest signals that we're going to look for.
Let me get our listeners involved here with their questions for Dr. Stephen Ilardi. 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. We're talking about depression in the wake of Robin Williams' passing. What's the difference, Doctor, between, you know, clinical depression and something you hear a lot about, which is bipolar disorder?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I really need to point out that there is an enormous amount of overlap between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So virtually everyone with so-called bipolar, and that word bipolar simply means going from one pole to another, one of those poles is depression. So virtually everyone with bipolar has episodes of clinical depression, and they're nearly indistinguishable from those that don't have bipolar that are simply what we would refer to as clinically depressed. But with bipolar disorder, there's this other end, which we refer to as mania, which is where energy and mood get pathologically elevated, which, you know, that almost sounds paradoxical. How can your mood be too high? How can your energy be too high when people are manic? They are so activated that they actually begin to lose touch with reality. They become often very impulsive, often have incredible functional impairment because their judgment goes out the window. They're often spending money they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
They're often engaging. They can become violent, not usually dangerously so, but agitated, aggressive, sexually impulsive. And often begin losing touch with reality, sometimes hearing voices, sometimes entertaining ideas that they have some sort of special messianic role. So that's the sort of defining feature of bipolar disorder.
Yeah. You know,
go ahead.
Well, I think people will wonder, are all suicides a result of depression of one kind or another?
The majority are. It turns out, depending on which study you want to attend to most closely, it's somewhere between about 65% and 85% of every person in the U.S. who takes their life. Probably about 3 out of 4 are clinically depressed. Many of the rest have some other form of psychiatric illness. Could be schizophrenia, could be bipolar. Many of them have substance use problems. So, yeah, the connection between depression and suicide is extremely strong.
Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Marcia from the Kansas side. Good morning, Marcia.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for calling.
Good. I had to talk because I've had severe depression since I was 11 years old, the kind that incapacitates me, like Robin Williams. And, you know, for a time, certain medications, well, I wasn't even on medication until I was about 30. Okay, but about 2 months ago, I got another bout of depression and couldn't get out of bed for a week and had to hide it from everybody. So I went to see a psychiatrist. He gave me a medication. It started to work, I am not kidding, in half an hour. And I was able to get up, go back to work, do what I do very well. And I'm a happy camper right now. But
wow.
I know exactly, I thought I was going to shoot myself. However, the only thing keeping me from not shooting myself, besides not having a gun, was that I thought I'd go to hell. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, boy. Marcia, I'm glad you called. And I was going to ask you, doctor, this notion of medication being a saving grace for so many folks. To what extent can medication help? And are there some folks that can't be helped by it?
Yeah, well, first of all, I really appreciate the call. And I do want to say there are probably millions of lives worldwide that have been saved by these medications. So they do help a number of people. But there's something else that it really pains me to say, and that is that the medications are definitely not effective for everyone. And in fact, as more data have been pouring in over the last 10, 15 years, what we're discovering is the medications have not lived up to our hopes that we had for them. Let me put some numbers on it and make it really clear for everyone.
Yeah.
In the short term, and what I mean by that is over the first couple of months, only about 50 to 60% of depressed individuals have what we think of as a favorable response to the medication. That means the meds are helping. In some cases, about 30%, the depressive symptoms completely go away in the short term. So that's great. But that means that for 70%, they don't completely go away. For 40 to 50%, they're really not going away much at all, at least on the first medication that's tried. If we look at the long term and we ask the question, what are the percent of depressed individuals who say over 5 years will go on a medication, have their symptoms completely go away, and they'll stay well? If all they do is take the pill and don't change anything else in their life, that number looks like it's less than 1 in 4.
Wow.
So the medications can be helpful. But, you know, the message that I've been telling my patients and the thing that's animated all of my clinical research over the last decade is a simple premise. We need to do better. We need to do better because this is a treacherous illness. And so, you know, I've been thinking.
And, doctor, you do better how? Because
well,
I believe you advocate a lifestyle-based approach, and I'm wondering what that is exactly. Yeah.
I do. And it's not an either-or, by the way. It's not that we tell our patients that they should stop taking their medication. In fact, far from it. It's often very difficult to come off a medication because there is a potential withdrawal syndrome. So we think of it as both and. But here's the thing. If we look at rates of clinical depression around the world, what we find is there's enormous variation. And we see the lowest rates of depression, rather surprisingly, among people who lead extremely hard lives, and that is modern-day Aboriginal groups, people like the Kaluli in Papua New Guinea in the highlands, people like the Yanomamo in the Amazonian basin. They're living extremely difficult lives, and yet they don't seem to get clinically depressed. We see much lower rates of depression, typically in traditional agrarian groups that live maybe the way our ancestors did several hundred years ago. The more westernized, modernized, industrialized a people's way of life, the higher the rate of this devastating illness.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, it's very interesting. And what it suggests is that depression belongs in a category that medical anthropologists have discovered of diseases of civilization. So think about the common denominator between heart disease and allergies and type 2 diabetes or even type 1 diabetes. All of these illnesses, lupus, I mean, it's a very long list. All of them look like diseases of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
They're artifacts of the mismatch between basically the lives that our bodies are designed to be living, and 21st century sedentary, fast food laden, sleep deprived, stressed out, socially isolated, indoor living. We're just not designed for the lives that we're living. At least we're not well designed for them.
And so you recommend what for given that, you recommend what to folks to help them combat their own depressions?
Yeah. Well, what I say is, we've all been educated that depression involves chemical imbalance. And indeed it does. In other words, depression is a brain disease. But here's the thing. There are lots of ways to change the brain. There are lots of ways of addressing neurochemical imbalance that have nothing to do with meds. So exercise profoundly changes the brain, physical activity. Now, you know, when I started talking to my colleagues about designing a lifestyle program for people who are depressed, and I would outline it. Now, let me give you the outline, and then I'll tell you their reaction. So I said, okay, well, here's what we know profoundly changes the depressed brain in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm.
Physical activity, bright light exposure, sunlight exposure, basically getting outside, changing diet, specifically adding omega-3 fatty acids, adding vitamin D, which we get partially from sunlight exposure, partially from certain parts of our diet, and dropping out inflammatory foods like dietary sugar, increasing socialization, improving, developing habits of healthy sleep, things like that. So my colleagues said to me, well, Steve, these are great ideas, but they're all the things that you can't do when you're depressed,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
They're the things you can't do when you're depressed. And I said, well, actually, no, these are things that are very difficult to initiate when you're clinically depressed. So what we've done at the University of Kansas is designed a program where we put a structure in place to help people who are depressed, help them slowly integrate these habits of lifestyle into their life. So what do? When it comes to physical activity, the first thing we do is we assign them a personal trainer.
Mm.
And when people, you know, contact me from all over the country, sometimes from other countries, they hear about our work and they say, well, you know, what can I do? I'll say, well, first of all, let's get you with a trained behavior therapist who can help you implement these programs. Secondly, best investment you can make is somebody who can actually be there to help prompt you to be physically active.
Right.
So that might mean, you know, in our program, you know, if Mrs. Jones is in the program and she's scheduled to meet with her trainer, she'll get a phone call 30 minutes before they're scheduled to. And by the way, their workout typically at the beginning is a brisk walk.
Mm-hmm.
There was a study at my alma mater, Duke University, in which severely depressed patients were randomly assigned to get Zoloft, an antidepressant, or brisk walking. The patients who did the brisk walking, 30 minutes, three times a week, did every bit as well in the short term as the patients on Zoloft.
Oh, that's interesting.
They were three times less likely to get depressed again over the follow-up than the patients who just got the medication but didn't change other habits.
Doctor, let me grab a phone call here from Lisa from Bonner Springs. Lisa, good morning. You're on Up to Date. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to call and say hello. And I was a participant in one of Dr. Alardi's TLC groups that brought in some people from Kansas City about 6 years ago. And I went through that program, and I found it incredibly helpful in terms of teaching me some lifestyle changes in fighting my depression.
I'm glad to hear that, Lisa. So you endorse what he's doing.
Yes, yes. And I think that the structured format was incredibly helpful in terms of we had group sessions where people were able to connect, which was part of the socialization process, learning about how the exercise could increase the sense of flow and taking the fish oil. Having someone that you could talk to and get some feedback and learning how to avoid rumination. I've used those strategies over the last 6 years, and when I find myself slipping, I know that I've probably slipped in some of those areas, and I get back to practicing those things.
Lisa, thank you for the call. And Dr. Alardi, we're out of time here, but if people want more information about your program, they can go where?
Well, they can go on your website. They can go to the website that we have at KU. It's psych.ku.edu/TLC. It stands for Therapeutic Lifestyle Change. They can also contact the KU Psychological Clinic. There are TLC groups that are ongoing. They're very affordable. I can give you the number. I don't know if you want it on air.
No, we'll just put a link on our webpage, kcur.org, doctor, and people can go there and get linked up to what you're doing. Hey, you've been just terrific. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
You bet.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Stephen Ilardi. He's a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Kansas.